From the studios of the North Carolina Reading Service, I'm John Federson, today bringing you the current issue of Indie Week. It's dated September 8th of 2021, and your North Carolina Reading Service provides this program for blind and print-impaired listeners. And welcome, everybody. And our regular listeners may recall last week's departure from our theme music to go to the realm of classical music, and there was so much response for our performance of John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And unfortunately, most of that response was invitations for me to leave town. And so we decided that we would go back to our regularly scheduled performers for our theme music today. And we should move right to our opening article, Lee Toss, News North Carolina Back to School Shootings. Last week, the parents of about 4,000 students received a text alert that made their hearts drop to their stomachs. Their child's school was on lockdown. A shooting had occurred. Frantic, they texted their kids, "Where are you? Are you okay? Are you safe?" North Carolina's first fully in-person school year since the start of the pandemic had only just begun. Last Monday, a 15-year-old student shot a classmate at New Hanover High School in Wilmington. The teen survived with injuries. 2 days later, a student at Mount Tabor High School in Winston-Salem, William Raynard Miller Jr., was shot and killed. The suspect is thought to be another student, though officials have been reluctant to release details, citing an ongoing investigation. And on Tuesday, guns were found on a 16-year-old student at Enloe High School in Raleigh. Two students were charged. Students are back in the classroom. Guns are, too. Raleigh-based Moms Demand Action volunteer Tony Cope, said, "There's no words to describe that sort of fear as a parent. Every parent at the school who got those texts is now trying to process that lingering fear. It leaves lasting scars." Cope has experienced that terror twice. Most recently, his 18-year-old daughter survived an active shooter at a friend's home while hiding in an upstairs bathroom where she quietly texted Cope. Before that, Cope survived a shooting at a Target in Apex, hiding in the aisles with his then 6-year-old daughter. Since then, he's advocated for gun control and gun safety with Moms Demand Action, a group formed after 20 young children were gunned down at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. Cope says he isn't surprised that a return to school has brought back school shootings. Gun sales surged during the pandemic. In 2020, people in the United States purchased nearly 23 million guns. That's just in 2020, a 64% increase over the previous year. About 40% of those purchases were first-time gun owners, according to a survey from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Cope says, "That means there's a lot of people not necessarily well-trained with handling or storing guns, and we've seen a spike in gun violence in every facet in our communities." Many school shooters get their weapons from the home of either a relative or a friend. Jessica Burroughs, campaign director of NC Gun Safety at Moms Rising, pointed out, "But confronting the issue at home isn't enough. Gun control laws need to be maintained and in some cases strengthened, and as a society, we must reevaluate a culture that teaches children," Burroughs said in a statement, "the answer to problems can be found at the end of a gun." And he went on, "Last week's tragedy at Mount Tabor High School, a second school shooting in North Carolina this week, is a painful reminder that we have failed in the very basic responsibility to keep our kids safe. We must prioritize the actions we've failed to take so far, and that starts with keeping all guns off of school campuses, period, no exceptions. The problem can be traced down from the top. For decades, Republicans have been working to peel back gun control laws. Just last week, Governor Roy Cooper vetoed a bill that would have removed the requirement that handgun owners obtain a permit from local law enforcement. saying in a statement, "At a time of rising gun violence, we can't afford to repeal a system that works to save lives. The legislature should focus on combating gun violence instead of making it easier for guns to end up in the wrong hands." And last month, State Attorney General Josh Stein joined 21 other attorneys general to call on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to close the ghost gun loopholes that allows people to buy and assemble untraceable guns at home. Stein said, "Gun violence is on the rise. We must make our communities safer, so I urge the federal government to make clear that ghost guns are firearms under federal law." Pushing for legislation is critical, Cope says, including increasing background checks and cracking down on unlicensed weapons dealers. Educating gun owners on safety can also stop firearms from getting into the wrong hands, Cope adds. That means separating ammunition from the gun, storing weapons in gun safes, and using gun locks. Cope says if the child doesn't get the gun, nothing with gun violence happens. And Tomasi McDonald now weighs in from Durham, the Equity Twins, about the Ward 1 race. Durham's two biggest political action committees released their endorsements last week, and one of the more intriguing contests in the state's bluest city is the Ward 1 race between incumbent city council member Didriana Freeman and challenger Marion Johnson. Freeman is a special assistant at Durham Children's Initiative, where she works with community partners to help children achieve academic success. Freeman was first elected to the council in 2017. Johnson works as a consultant with Frontline Solutions, a black-owned social justice firm in Durham that supports nonprofits and foundations with an eye on diversity, equity, and inclusion. She has served on the board of the People's Alliance, including a one-year stint as co-chair. She currently serves as chair of Durham's Participatory Budgeting Steering Committee. It would not be improper or inaccurate to describe Freeman and Johnson as the, quote, equity twins of the upcoming municipal elections. Johnson on Friday told Indy in an email that she and Freeman are both progressive candidates who both believe in equity and inclusion as critical values for Durham. Johnson says, "Where I believe we differ is in terms of how we create a progressive vision for Durham. Councilmember Freeman's votes against the affordable housing bond and against participatory budgeting are two examples of places where we disagree." The incumbent says that though she and Johnson share similar progressive views, their strengths don't align. Freeman, in an email to Indy, says that she stands for, quote, equity as a way of life, and that Johnson is not aware of the facts surrounding her vote against that $95 million affordable housing bond referendum, approved by nearly 80% of Durham residents in November of 2019, that city leaders touted as the largest in the state's history. Freeman wrote, "The vote on the issues concerning the affordable housing bond was to continue the pursuit of closing the gap in funding renovations, as proposed by the Durham Housing Authority. My ultimate decision was clearly based on the then facts, or lack thereof. Council hastily pushed for a $95 million bond, which barely scratches the surface of an overall $544 million deficit left to our communities." The Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, PAC, has endorsed Freeman. In a recent statement, the PAC said she, quote, has proven to be steadfast in her commitment to a more equitable Durham during her time on the City Council. Racial equity is embedded in all of her decision-making. She has a clear handle on her job and is willing to ask tough questions. The People's Alliance, PAC, on Thursday endorsed Johnson, calling her an essential voice for the city. Quote, from her work opposing Amendment 1 to her chairing of Durham's experiment in radical and inclusive democracy through participatory budgeting, Marion T. Johnson is a necessary leader for our time, they said on its website. Both candidates have deeply loyal followers, even among city council members, in what is expected to be a close race. Councilmember Mark Anthony Middleton, the lone candidate to garner endorsements from both PACs, has endorsed Freeman. Quote, "There is no more insistent voice than hers in the Durham public square calling us to the realization that the work of true racial equity is hard and at times uncomfortable. She is the epitome of the Socratic gadfly and a champion of those that too often don't get a second thought from the privileged and powerful." Fellow council member Jillian Johnson has planted one of Johnson's campaign signs in the front yard of her home. "I'm supporting Marion Johnson," she says, "because I think she's the best candidate in the race. I believe in her vision for our city, and I think she has the right combination of policy expertise, focus, and empathy to help move this city forward." In response to a People's Alliance candidate's question about the single most important issue facing the city of Freeman, said leaders should focus on the issues of social, economic, and environmental justice, quote, "with an equity lens to envision a city where everyone can safely live, work, worship, and play. As an elected official, I can say that the issues confronting the city and council are interrelated, from gun violence to housing to racism. As a public health crisis, we have to tackle all the issues in tandem with an understanding of how moving resources or support will impact another area. Equity must be at the foundation of what we do, because what we see in the other issues is a result of inequities." In her response, Johnson said the single most important issue the city currently faces is an economic crisis in the wake of COVID-19. She wrote the city, quote, "still has the potential and ability to make strong progressive budgets," and she supports a $25 an hour wage for municipal employees and contractors. She supports free public transit, prioritizing infrastructure maintenance and repairs in low-income neighborhoods. Johnson added that a housing shortage, particularly with affordable housing, is a challenge for the city, a problem exacerbated by gentrification and displacement, especially of black families. She wrote, "COVID-19 accelerated the eviction rate, the rate at which people become homeless, and the widening wealth gap between homeowners and renters. The people who are most vulnerable are people who have unstable or unofficial housing agreements or are renting month to month because they often don't qualify for typical tenant protections. There's a growing resentment among black and brown residents threatened with displacement by more affluent white newcomers who are purchasing homes thousands of dollars above already inflated prices due to the housing shortage. As a consequence, some political observers say Durham is facing a new kind of existential threat. Now that the Bull City is prospering, who gets to live here? Only a little less than 4% of the combined $160 million from the housing bond and its complementary funds will go toward home ownership, long recognized as the most effective way to build wealth in low-income communities, according to a housing policy case study from the online housing policy resource platform Local Housing Solutions. Another $4.6 million will go to fund minor repairs for low-income homeowners with code violations, bringing the total allocated for home ownership to a mere 6.8%. While addressing the issue of affordable housing in the questionnaire, Freeman said that during her 2017 campaign, she, quote, "put forth ideas to equitably address displacement caused by gentrification and proposed a $100 million bond to pay for these efforts," adding, quote, "many of these ideas are in the 2019 housing bond referendum." Freeman said that addressing the challenge of affordable housing will require more than a housing plan, quote, "to make affordable housing a sustainable reality and prevent homelessness, we must also address job training, entrepreneurship, small business incubation and public health and safety concerns. Similarly, in the Durham Committee questionnaire, Johnson said the city's housing crisis goes hand in hand with this economic crisis, she wrote. While our rent and our housing prices are exploding, our wages are stagnating. According to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition's latest report, the housing wage in the Triangle is about $21.81 per hour. Advocating for a living wage of $15 an hour isn't sufficient anymore. We need to be advocating for a thriving wage of $25 an hour, enough for people to consistently keep their heads above water and not be one missed paycheck away from disaster, unquote. Freeman's and Johnson's mutual push for equity is best reflected in their dual concerns for tenants' rights and desires to avert a housing crisis compounded with the end of the CDC eviction moratorium. Early last month, Freeman introduced a resolution intended to protect tenants with a Tenants' Bill of Rights, drafted by Bull City Tenants United, a Durham advocacy group for low-income renters. In the People's Alliance PAC questionnaire, Johnson praised Durham's Emergency Rental Assistance Program as, quote, a great example of how leadership can leverage multiple levels of support, city, county, and federal, to best serve and protect residents. Our cover story from this week's issue of Indie Week, the Delta variant. It's an alternate THC compound which has emerged while cannabis advocates are divided over how best to use the plant. There's a photo in it from the Southern Hemp Expo 2021 at Raleigh Convention Center. On the main stage of that convention center, physician Uma Dhanabalan gestures behind a podium, talking about scientific studies, research, and the global economy. It's Thursday morning, and the third annual Southern Hemp Expo resembles nothing so much as a business conference. The only difference is the people. Instead of men in business suits, there are middle-aged couples, millennials, and budding young entrepreneurs. Matthew Suarez of Massachusetts drove 12 hours south to attend the expo, he told the Indy. He says, I'm starting a hemp clothing company. I think there's a business opportunity there, but I also think there's a necessity to increase the use of industrial hemp for a variety of different things. From a young age, Suarez says, he didn't understand why the production of industrial hemp was suppressed. Today, he talks about how growing hemp can help return carbon to the earth. There's a huge need for regenerative farming, he says. Quote, no plant is more efficient at sequestering carbon than industrial hemp. It's a necessity, environmentally, for us to do this. It makes no sense that it's not being cultivated on a really large scale in the United States. Suarez's business is a safe bet in an uncertain industry. Although some cannabis products became legal in North Carolina in 2015, many still exist in a gray area. The line is a blurry one. Any cannabis derivative with less than 0.3% THC, the chemical in marijuana responsible for its characteristic high, is legal to grow and sell. That's 0.3%. That includes CBD and other compounds like CBN and CBG, which does not have a psychoactive effect. Although research is scarce, hemp products are often advertised for their alleged calming or anti-inflammatory properties as sleep aids or pain relievers. On the other hand, there are compounds like Delta 8, an alternate form of THC often described as a weed light. While Delta 8 will give people a high, its effects are usually less intense than traditional marijuana, as long as you don't take too much, says Tanya Durand, owner of The Hemp Store, with locations in Raleigh, Chapel Hill, and Wake Forest. She says, Delta 8 THC is an isomer of cannabis, so it's naturally occurring in the plant, but in order to produce large amounts of it, they do have to process it from CBD. It turns into delta H-THC, which is psychoactive. It's very similar to delta 9-THC, which is the main component in marijuana. The legality of delta 8 is somewhat ambiguous, said Paul Adams, who's an industrial hemp program manager at NC Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. In an email, he told the Indy, according to the Drug Enforcement Administration, synthesized or manufactured THC products like Delta 8 are just as illegal as marijuana. But Adams adds, quote, it seems that if Delta 8 THC could be extracted from a hemp plant directly in volumes large enough to use, then that Delta 8 would be legal. It's unclear if CBD derived from hemp and then acted upon to create Delta H results in a legal product, he said. So far, the law has given dispensaries enough leeway to sell Delta 8. The new compound is definitely the current craze, says Durand, with about 70% of her customers looking for it when they come into the store. Not everyone, though, is looking to get high, she says. That's the surprising part. We get people who are about to turn 21 waiting to be able to purchase it. We have middle-aged people coming in, older people who said they've never tried it but heard from a friend that it really helped them with their arthritis or whatever it was. We're seeing all kinds of people. Delta 8 and other THC alternatives have divided the cannabis community into people who think the plant should primarily be used to make industrial products like clothing and biofuel, and dispensary owners who believe in the medical benefits of CBD and THC, some of whom are in favor of widespread legalization of marijuana. One of those owners is Durand, who said she's used illegal cannabis in the past to treat migraines, postpartum depression, and anxiety, and was later amazed at the benefits of hemp. I've always believed that cannabis was medicinal, she said. North Carolina may soon take the first step toward legalization with a bill that would allow the use of medical marijuana, if approved, Senate Bill 711, or the Compassionate Care Act, would be one of the strictest in the country, allowing the use of marijuana only for patients with debilitating medical conditions such as cancer, epilepsy, or PTSD. Production and sale of medical marijuana would also be severely limited, with no more than 40 stores allowed statewide. The legalization of medical marijuana across the nation has been driven, in part, by scientific research showing cannabis can relieve chronic pain and may have benefits for nausea, spasms, and seizures. But with marijuana still classified as a Schedule I drug by the federal government, research is limited. The criminalization of marijuana has created a catch-22 in the rapidly growing hemp industry. Sellers of CBD or other cannabinoids are barred from advertising them as medically beneficial because there's not enough research to prove they are. Most of the evidence is anecdotal. On the other hand, doctors and scientists who want to discover what benefits CBD and other cannabinoids can have, if any, are hindered by severe restrictions on research, a long-lasting legacy from the war on drugs. At the Hemp Expo, small business owners are selling every cannabis product you can imagine: cigars, cigarettes, pre-rolls, vape cartridges, gummies, chocolate bars, tinctures, dog treats. College students looking for Delta 8 walk alongside third-generation farmers investing in a new crop. At one hemp dispensary, it feels like you've walked back into the 1960s with a large sign that reads, "Find Your Groove." In the next booth, managers at Aurum Labs explain how their scientists test hemp and cannabis products to determine their purity and potency, identifying different strains and looking for traces of pesticides or heavy metals. An entire microeconomy has sprung up around this now legal plant. Businesses catering to hemp farmers who need equipment, insurance, development, testing, and distribution. The question is, will it last? You won't find any doubt at the Hemp Expo, one business rep, an insurance agent, said. Right now, we're all pioneers. Soon, it's going to be real. Next, I'm going to move to the Indie Week's online content, some of which doesn't make it into the current print issue, but is just as important as what they usually carry. It might appear next week in print. But this is also originally published on North Carolina Policy Watch. Judge gives state lawmakers one more last chance to fully fund the Leandro Plan. Superior Court Judge David Lee has given state lawmakers one more last chance to meet their constitutional obligation to provide students in North Carolina with a sound basic education before he takes action to force their hand. Lee, the judge overseeing the state's long-running Leandro school funding case, made his remarks Wednesday during a court hearing with lawyers for defendants and plaintiffs. He gave lawmakers until October 15 to fully fund a school improvement plan that calls for $5.5 billion in new K-12 funding by 2028. An October 18th hearing has been set to discuss the next step if an agreement has not been reached to fully fund that plan. He said, I'm going to be prepared on October 18th to hear any proposal that anyone might have in terms of how the court might exercise its remedial powers to remedy this constitutional deficiency. He said it's disheartening that the House and Senate budgets are, quote, woefully short of the money needed to meet the Leandro mandate. The House's budget is more generous of the two, calling for $370 million in new money this year and $382 million next year. Meanwhile, the Senate budget, $192 million this year and $214 million next year, both are hundreds of millions of dollars short of the $691 million called for this year and the $1.06 billion needed next year. Lee says, I'm giving the legislative and executive branches one more last chance before they say we're through. That's not to threaten anybody. It's to send a clear signal, clear as I know how, that come October 18, if this hasn't already been addressed as it should be, as the court finds it needs to be, then the court will certainly be prepared to address it. The Leandro case began more than a quarter century ago after five rural school districts in low-wealth counties sued the state, arguing they couldn't raise the tax revenue needed to provide students with a quality education. In 1997, the state Supreme Court issued a ruling, later reconfirmed in 2004, in which it held that every child has a right to, quote, a sound basic education that includes competent and well-trained teachers and principals, and equitable access to resources. Lee said, we're not just throwing money at something. We're asking that this state comply with the state constitution by adequately funding a very reasoned and intense effort to come up with what's necessary to comply with our constitution. As Policy Watch reported in July, there are numerous examples in other states of examples in which courts have forced reluctant lawmakers to adequately fund K-12 education. In 2015, for example, the Washington State Supreme Court held the state in contempt of court and fined it $100,000 a day after it failed to come up with a plan to adequately fund K-12 as required by a court order. The fine came after threats of sanctions if lawmakers did not live up to what that state's constitution calls a paramount duty to amply fund schools. Lee says he's aware of the actions taken in other states. Quote, I've read some of the things that have happened in Kansas, Washington, and some of the other states that have similar constitutional provisions, but I'm not prepared to shine a light on that this morning. I will be prepared to shine a light on that on October the 18th. Republican lawmakers have said that Lee doesn't have the authority to force the state to fund the Leandro Plan. They also contend the House and Senate budgets include elements of the plan. Another from online article, North Carolina just enacted ambitious criminal justice reform legislation. Governor Cooper signed a comprehensive criminal justice reform package, Senate Bill 300, into law last Thursday. It became effective immediately. The bill, originally sponsored by Republicans with input from Democrats, gained bipartisan support, though not universal acclaim. A press release from Cooper's office touted the fact that the bill included provisions recommended by the Task Force for Racial Equity in Criminal Justice that the governor established in June of 2020. And his quote is as follows. Senate Bill 300 makes important changes to improve policing and criminal justice in North Carolina, as recommended by TREC, that's the Task Force for Racial Equity, including it promotes recruitment of officers with diverse backgrounds and experiences and improves training so that officers are better equipped to be successful. It requires early intervention mechanisms to identify and correct officers who use excessive force or other misconduct. It furthers independent investigation of police-involved shootings. It limits local laws that criminalize poverty. And it requires a first appearance in court within 72 hours of a person being arrested. The bill also won praise from law enforcement officials. In a press release, the North Carolina Sheriff's Association applauded the sponsors of the bill for soliciting and considering the input of the organization. This legislation will enhance the criminal justice system and law enforcement profession, said the press release. Senator Vicky Sawyer, a Republican representing Iredale and Yadkin County, said the legislation brought together groups with opposing views, including law enforcement and criminal justice reform organizations. On a talk show, Sawyer co-hosted, Senator Danny Britt, a Robeson County Republican and sponsor of the legislation, echoed that assessment. Britt said that in developing the bill, he took recommendations from different work groups, told law enforcement representatives to come up with confines to put around the bill, and then asked for feedback from civil rights group. He said, the biggest highlight of that bill is it creates several different databases for decertification of law enforcement officers' use of deadly force involving officers. It provides a way to discover if an officer has an arrest out of state that may or may not show up here. It really allows law enforcement to hire the best and brightest and weed out a few bad apples that we do have. The majority of law enforcement do an excellent job, and they do what's right all the time. Despite the bipartisan plaudits the legislation received, not everyone marked its enactment as unqualified success. In a press release issued prior to that bill signing, Daniel Bowes, Director of Policy and Advocacy for the ACLU of North Carolina, decried the lobbying efforts of the NC Conference of District Attorneys and the North Carolina Sheriff's Association that prevented what he described as critical criminal justice reforms from being included in that bill, saying, quote, the law enforcement training and oversight provisions in SB 300 rely on and perpetuate the falsehoods that the failings of the criminal legal system are the result of a few bad apples, and that the police can police themselves. Dawn Bligrove, executive director of criminal justice nonprofit Emancipate NC, expressed similar sentiments. SB 300 makes important strides for first appearances in misdemeanor cases, but does little else to create much-needed equity or advance the level of accountability for law enforcement the people need. Here's what's in this reform package. Strengthening law enforcement accountability. Law enforcement officers now have a duty to intervene and report when they see other officers using excessive force. Many criminal justice research organizations have called for the inclusion of such a duty to intervene in police conduct requirements. The law creates a public certification, revocation, and suspension database of law enforcement officers. The Criminal Justice Standards Division of the Department of Justice will create a database of police-involved incidents involving use of force. This critical incident database will be for internal review and study only, however, and will not be available to the general public. An internal warning system will also be put in place for law enforcement agencies to use in monitoring officer actions and behaviors, including the discharge of a firearm, the use of force, and citizen complaints. Oversight. State agencies, including the SBI, will be required, upon the request of a governor, sheriff, chief of police, head of a state agency, district attorney, or the commissioner of prisons, required to investigate deaths that result from the use of force by law enforcement officers, as well as deaths of incarcerated people. The new law strengthens the disclosure of law enforcement credibility when officers serve as witnesses in trials, as recommended by the NC Sheriff's Association in a 2020 report. Any certified law enforcement or justice officer who is notified that they may be not called to testify at a trial based on bias, interest, or lack of credibility should report to the Criminal Justice Standards Division, notifying them of the same. Training and certification. Any individual applying to be certified as a law enforcement or justice officer will now need to go through background checks. Agencies will need to submit fingerprints of these applicants and others already certified to the FBI. It's hoped that will help identify any criminal history of prospective and current law enforcement personnel. It will also be required that various training commissions run applicants through the National Decertification Index. The law establishes a uniform minimum training standards for the state. The training commissions will develop a guide for increasing the diversity of the police force. Body camera footage disclosure. In cases of police violence that result in deaths or serious injury, relatives of victims and their legal representatives can request the disclosure of body camera footage, and law enforcement agencies must then file a petition to the Superior Court within 3 business days. A judge then needs to return a decision on that disclosure within 7 days of that filing. If they deny the request, a review will be conducted within 20 days of that ruling. However, the footage will not be immediately available to the public, which is governed by the provision about the release of such recordings. The law makes it a misdemeanor to make a copy of the recording and a crime to disseminate the content. Emancipate NC Director Don Blagrove criticized the last-minute modification to the body camera provision, saying it shifts the burden to family members to seek the disclosure. She added that the previously law enforcement officials had the discretion to show videos to family members without needing judicial approval. Mental health. The law institutes a requirement for officers to be screened for mental health issues in certification and go through training. Healthcare providers will now be able to transport respondents with mental illness in involuntary commitment proceedings, at which a court decides whether to force patients into custody of mental health facilities. Previously, sheriff's deputies were solely responsible for transporting patients involved in the involuntary commitment process to and from facilities, often shackling or handcuffing them, as North Carolina Health News reported. First appearances. The law modifies that law regulating first appearance hearings at which district judges review criminal charges and decide whether a defendant should be released, bonded out, deferred, or acquitted. The law shortens the maximum waiting period between the commitment to jail and the first appearance hearing from 96 hours to 72, with the objective of ensuring speedy trials while accommodating weekend schedules. It also adds a first appearance requirement for people charged with a misdemeanor. Criminal charges, punishment, and rulemaking. The law will establish a special group to study the state's criminal laws and make legislative recommendations. The bipartisan North Carolina Legislative Working Group on Criminal Law Recodification will facilitate streamlining the state criminal code and develop a database of crimes and offenses under different statutes, common law, regulations, and ordinances. North Carolina's criminal system is based on structured sentencing, with sentencing grids detailing the sentences that individuals should receive for various offenses, including minimum and maximum. However, certain ordinances will no longer impose a criminal penalty under the new law. People who are charged can also seek dismissal if they don't pick up another charge related to that ordinance within 30 days, or by addressing the underlying condition for the offense. This provision was introduced via an amendment by Senator Mujtaba Mohammed, Democrat of Mecklenburg. He told Policy Watch, hundreds of people are frequently charged with crimes for local ordinance violations, including public urination or sleeping on a park bench or failure to pay bus fares. And he said, we're not criminalizing poverty at the end of the day, and that's what we've done for far too long. And sadly, our local governments have participated in that with their own local ordinances. Apart from police accountability, the law also creates a new felony for resisting a law enforcement officer if such action results in injuries to the officer. The satellite-based monitoring program that some sex offenders are subject to is now limited to a lifetime maximum of 10 years. Now, only re-offenders with two or more convictions for a felony need to register for the program. Judicial review can terminate such monitoring. The North Carolina Criminal Justice Education and Training Standards Commission and the North Carolina Sheriff's Education Training Standards Commission, which are responsible for law enforcement training, will be empowered to develop minimum standards for in-service training without having to go through the lengthy rulemaking process. Also, again, from the online version of Indy Week, this is a short article from the Lee Toss, one of the contributors and editors, that I struggled with a little bit, except that it's got important news baked into it. Richmond's alternative weekly newspaper, Style Weekly, printed its final issue today after nearly four decades of covering news and culture in the River City. The paper is owned by Alden Global Capital, a cannibalistic hedge fund known for sucking the life out of the publications in its portfolio by gutting staff and selling off real estate. The publisher posted a brief note on Facebook Tuesday stating the paper's September 8th issue would be its last. Editor-in-Chief Brent Baldwin, quote, we thank our talented staff for their award-winning efforts and our loyal readers for their support. Thank you, Richmond. Founded in 1982, the paper was owned by Tribune Publishing, which was acquired by Alden earlier this year for $633 million. 2 years after buying that media giant, Alden began offering buyouts, according to the Chicago Tribune. Alden, the second largest newspaper publisher by circulation in the country, is known for making steep cuts and essentially bleeding its papers dry. The news highlights the grim economic outlook of alternate weeklies, alt-weeklies, made more precarious by the pandemic. Just as COVID began to sweep the nation, The Stranger, Seattle's iconic alt-weekly, laid off 18 employees. Euclid Media, which owns seven alt-weeklies, including the Orlando Weekly and the Detroit Metro Times, furloughed 70% of its staff. Minnesota's City Pages shuttered last fall. Neiman Lab, a news industry think tank, pondered whether COVID spelled, quote, total annihilation for the alt-weekly industry. This week, the death knell came for Style. We pour one out for you, comrades. The Indy is lucky. We are not owned by a hedge fund, but our owner has publicly stated he's interested in selling the paper. Like everyone else in our industry, we are struggling to swim upstream. To help support local journalism, please consider joining the Indy Week's Press Club. And the online version now has many more stories of much longer length. Former Army missile plant in Burlington poses an urgent public health risk, is just one of them. Continue masking, require vaccines, the Wake County School Board is stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'll continue now a return for what time remains to the print edition. I'm going to move us now over to an arts session, a column by Brian Howe, and it's titled Night Vision. The jazz singer, Kate McGarry, already had one Grammy nomination in 2009 when she arrived in Durham from New York with Keith Gans, her partner in music and life, who grew up in the area. She's earned two more since then. The subject tonight is love, with Gans and their longtime keyboardist Gary Versace got the nod in 2018 for its sensitive settings of poetry by Hafiz. McGarry was recognized again in 2020 for her part in a large ensemble album by the visionary John Hollenbeck. In all that time, though, another record, their white whale, as McGarry says, was taking shape. It finally saw the light of day, to use a cliché advisedly, last week. What to Wear in the Dark features Gans, Versace, and nine other musicians, including McGarry's first work with the trumpeter Ron Miles of Bill Frisell fame. It proffers fresh, vivacious jazz interpretations of pop music from the late 60s and 70s, Steely Dan, Joni Mitchell, Cat Stevens, and the Beatles, Here Comes the Sun. Yet for all of their comforting familiarity, these arrangements emerge from some of McGarry's and Gans's hardest times, and the album is sequenced as the same kind of lifeline for listeners through the dark and out again that creating it was for them. McGarry is already renowned for the winning naturalness with which she blurs jazz into folk and pop, from Peter Gabriel to Bjork, and What to Wear in the Dark continues that tradition with a graceful gravitas. And the rest of this little article is a question-answer. What brought you to Durham, Kate? What first brought this music out was that we lost a lot of people in a short time. Both my parents, Keith's dad, and a real seminal teacher of mine. It's very disorienting when the people who kind of hold you are just wiped out and you're like, well, who am I? Looking down the road at New York, as much community and great things as we had there, we were longing for a more peaceful, sustainable situation. Keith, we loved it here, but she had no connection to anyone, and I immediately went on tour with Harry Connick Jr. And Kate, I was really in a kind of free-fall space. I sort of lost my identity as a singer. Then I had a career-threatening vocal injury. This snowball of big events was jarring, and these arrangements started to come in places of real despair. It sounds corny, but it was something sustaining and real, like a thread to hold on to in these old songs. Other songs started to come that were a reflection of jarring world events that were happening. Question. As someone who has made many 90s music Spotify playlists during the pandemic, I relate to that urge to reach for familiar, comforting songs. Keith says, she already had the name for the record before the pandemic, which turned out to be the perfect time to release it. We didn't know how dark things would be. Kate, the pandemic afforded us the opportunity to finish the record. We had had one recording session in 2017 and then another just before everything shut down. We ended up having this year to sculpt it and put it together, and we did one more song that was the capstone, Cat Stevens' On the Road to Find Out, with Becca Stevens and Michelle Willis. Question. The record starts with Dancing in the Dark, and given your track record in the context, I genuinely thought it was going to be Springsteen. Why Sinatra? And Kate McGarry answers, it felt like the beginning of the record. It was sort of like going from a time of naivete and innocence into the darkness where you can't tell what's coming. We had the old-timey bass drum and Gary playing accordion. We always have a foot in both camps, one in jazz and one in some kind of folk or pop camp, so it's pretty true to form to include some standards. Steely Dan, Joni Mitchell, those are things a listener might expect from an album like this, but I don't think anyone saw Desperado coming, and you play it really straight. Kate, there was a time when there were so many mass shootings every week. I had a sense of the aloneness of people, and it felt kind of like a prayer to reach somebody. That seems like it's grown even more, the loneliness that drives people to do horrible things. It happens all the time in heaven, brings us back to Hafiz. And Kate says, he's a 14th century poet saint, but he's so contemporary. He cuts through bullshit and says the truth. It was inspiring to me the way he talks about love among men and women, men and men, women and women. The main thing is, how can I be more loving to you? Speaking of cutting through bull, I have to ask about your spiel at the beginning of the 59th Street Bridge song. Kate says, as we worked on the main arrangement, which was really about reconnecting to the joy of life, I was feeling that the over-monetization of the music industry and self-promotion machine, all those things had just gotten so ramped up. I remembered this book by Hal Galper called The Touring Musician. I wanted to put in a paragraph for contrast, with everybody playing free and raucous, and then have a release. And the last question. You recently did a live stream at Sharp 9 Gallery in Durham. How challenging is it to promote this record? And Kate answers, that was the first time we had played the music with a full band in 16 months, and it was really fun. I'm very sad to see it doesn't really feel like it's safe to go back out. The idea that we would bring family, people, and friends, family together when they might not get sick, it just feels like it's not time. Luckily, Resilience Music Alliance is a dream label, and I feel like they're going to help us get the music out there, despite the lack of touring opportunities now. Now, I think one of the last articles I'll be able to excerpt is about the Hopscotch Music Festival, a big festival here in downtown Raleigh, beginning today and running through Saturday. And it says that tickets for that run from $80 to $300. It's by Jordan Lawrence, this column. Throwing a music festival is about as small details as booking cool acts. Right now, these details are proving to be difficult. Nathan Price, director of Hopscotch Music Festival, which returns this week after losing last year to COVID, tended to one of the myriad little difficulties as he spoke to Indie Week 7 days before the event. He says, there's some things, extra hoops and stuff like that you have to jump through this year, which we're happy to do, but sometimes they come out of nowhere. Of course, not all the obstacles to bringing Hopscotch back for an 11th outing were so small. For the sake of public health, the typically club-heavy festival will take place entirely outdoors, straining to present the prismatic selection of musical styles attendees expect, while cutting out the 10 indoor venues it utilized in 2019, performing solely on a pair of open-air stages. As a result, this year's Hopscotch is reduced to just 28 acts. Last one had 137. August the 20th brought a further complication. With COVID surging and the Delta threatening, Hopscotch announced a requirement for attendees to show proof of vaccination or a negative test within 72 hours, which meant figuring out more new logistics with 20 days to plan and implement. Given all this, it's impressive how much ground this year's lineup manages to cover. There are lofty indie acts and ascending pop artists, hip-hop innovators, and Americana enliveners. And for a festival happening entirely on big outdoor stages, a surprising number of wild-eyed experimentalists. Metal and other heavy music are the only perennial Hopscotch hallmark not on the menu. Price explains that such extreme sounds were harder to make work with this year's format. You don't really want to put a crazy noise artist in front of kids and stuff like that, he says. But I think we still were able to touch a lot of different genres and get a little bit of everything out there. Hopscotch's variety will be enriched by its downtown's many clubs, which will host the expected unofficial day parties as well as evening shows in the absence of official indoor offerings. While they didn't program these bills, Price said organizers communicated with the venues about their safety plans and that most were already prioritizing public health, with protocols for attendees and holding performances outside where possible. Carly Hertzman sings and plays guitar in Wednesday, a rising indie rock band out of Asheville that plays the festival for a second time. She says maintaining the day, party, and evening club presence is crucial to her expectation that hopscotch will still feel like hopscotch. But she says while the opportunity to perform is meaningful, hopscotch enacting its recent public health protocols was crucial to her feeling okay about participating. I'm going to cut to the end, which shows the schedule, and I will read as much of that just to outline it as I can in the minute or so I have remaining. So today at 5:15 p.m. in Moore Square Park, few of the many acts reviving and evolving indies heft like Asheville's Wednesday. On this year's Twin Plagues, the bands drift towards a shoegaze with the reverberating weight of guitars and bass. And Sarah Shook and the Disarmers comes on at Moore Square at 7 p.m. And Caroline Polachek at City Plaza, 9:30 p.m. Tomorrow, Friday, September 10th, and I'm reading this, of course, on Thursday. The Dead Tongues is at Moore Square Park, another hopscotch regular. And Micaiah McCraven performs City Plaza at 7:45. City Plaza Flying Lotus at 9:30. And Saturday, the last day official, Bower Birds at 5:15 p.m. Moore Square. And Colin Stetson, City Plaza, 6 p.m. And Archers of Loaf at Moore Square Park, 8:45 p.m. Now, two long articles in the print version of Indie Week, Learning Loss. Sobering test results confirm the pandemic's toll on North Carolina students. And An Education by Tito Craig. On the Mexican border, a Triangle resident learns from immigrants hoping to settle in the United States. And our clock has wound me down. And this was a big issue, including the online publication of Indie Week. And we hope that you can listen to any of this that you want to rehear at the podcast section of ncreadingservice.org. It'll be available there starting on Friday evening, I believe. And so John Federson now for the North Carolina Reading Service, closing this broadcast of the Indie Week Alt Independent Journal, which I hope you'll read more and listen next week. So long, everybody.